Thank you very much for that special music, Mr. Creed. It's very nice, and I just want to thank Mr. Witt for his message. I also enjoyed that very much. Well, I should warn you, brother, and just in advance here, my Jano's telling me there's a storm coming through North Branch here shortly, so hopefully we won't lose signal or anything or have any thunderstorms in the background, but in any case, if something happens, we'll jump back online and get things working as quickly as we can, but we'll stay quick. Nothing goes wrong, I think. In upstate New York, on a hilltop outside the town of Victory, stands a solitary monument. A white obelisk stabbing toward the sky, commemorating what has been called the most important battle of the last 1,000 years, the Battle of Saratoga. On each of the four sides of the monument is a niche for the four American commanders who led the Continental forces in this historic battle. Three of these niches contain bronze statues to honor these men. But the fourth stands conspicuously empty. Before the Battle of Saratoga, the Americans were getting beaten, and getting beaten badly. The British Army had defeated George Washington's army, and it was all the Continental Congress could do to flee Philadelphia before the British marched in and occupied our nation's first capital. The Continental Army was in disarray. The fledgling American government was on the run, and to top it off, a second British army was descending from Canada to hammer the final nail into the coffin. And the only army standing between the British and their total victory in the war was led by a man named Horatio Gates. A statue of General Gates stands in the north-facing niche of the Saratoga Victory Monument. But despite the victory that occurred under his overall command, General Gates has gone down in history as one of the worst leaders of the Revolutionary War. A man whose ego outstripped his abilities, who actively sought to undermine his superiors and for his own selfish ambitions, and who claimed credit for the successes of the more competent men who served beneath him. Early in the war, before the Battle of Trenton, where George Washington would win a critical victory for the Americans, Gates had strongly advised against attacking Trenton and actually advocated for retreat instead. But Washington decided to proceed against his advice. So, instead of supporting his commander-in-chief, Gates faked an illness and to get out of participating in the battle. And while the men under his command were fighting, he rode to the Continental Congress to badmouth Washington and request that he, Gates, replace Washington as commander-in-chief of the American forces. An offer the Congress declined after Washington won the battle that Gates had abandoned. Not learning his lesson, Gates would try the same tricks again after the Battle of Saratoga, but his underhanded efforts would again fail to undermine Washington. However, later in the war, General Gates would be given the command that he coveted in the South, where his true colors and ability would finally be revealed to everyone when he botched the Battle of Camden. Not only did he lose this battle against a much smaller British force, but as soon as the battle started to go poorly for him, Gates abandoned his men and fled the field on horseback, while his army bravely fought on in his absence. It's been said that Gates' only accomplishment in the battle was to cover 170 miles on horseback in his desperate 3-day retreat from it. General Gates would narrowly escape a court-martial for his action in the battle, but this debacle was years after the Battle of Saratoga. And in our greatest hour of need, leading up to the most pivotal battle of the war, Gates was the man in charge. The one whom all the Continental America's hopes were pinned to keep total victory out of the hands of the British at the Battle of Saratoga. Luckily for the Americans, it was not Gates' leadership that would determine the ultimate fate of the battle, This honor would go to one of his subordinates. A brigadier general would turn the tide at two critical moments in the battle, whose leadership and strategic acumen would stave off the British advances, and through his personal heroism and self-sacrifice would lead the final decisive charge that rallied the floundering American forces, broke the British line, and led to a decisive victory on the battlefield at Saratoga. During this valiant charge, this man would be dismounted by a shot through the leg, leaving him bedridden for months and permanently crippling his leg. But this man, this brigadier general, is not even mentioned on the victory monument at Saratoga. While Gates's statue stands boldly in his north-facing niche, south-facing niche, only an empty space for the man who contributed so much to changing the course of the Revolutionary War. And that's because the name of this man, this war hero, was Benedict Arnold. Many historians have said that if Arnold had been killed at Saratoga, instead of just being wounded in the leg, he would have been remembered today as one of our country's greatest heroes, one of our most beloved heroes and forefathers, right up there with George Washington and Benjamin Franklin. Schools, towns, and even counties would be named after him. But instead, his name lives in infamy. Is used even today as a synonym for traitor. Because 3 years after the victory at Saratoga, Arnold would betray the American cause and join the British. At the time, Benjamin Franklin was quoted as saying that Judas sold only one man, Arnold, 3 millions. For over 200 years, the name Benedict Arnold has been among the most reviled in our country. Thinking back in my own life, I can't think of a single American I've ever met who even has the name Benedict. Perhaps you do, but I've never met one. It's kind of surprising. All the good that Arnold did early in the Revolutionary War was forgotten because of his betrayal. Even today, his name conjures images of deception and treachery in the minds of those who hear it. What images appear in someone's head when they hear your name? When they hear my name? What does it mean to them? What is your name synonymous with? Does it matter? Let's turn to the book of Proverbs. We'll start reading in Proverbs chapter 22. And let's read verse 1. Proverbs 22 and verse 1. Proverbs 22, 1. A good name is to be chosen rather than great riches, loving favor rather than silver and gold. Elsewhere in Ecclesiastes 7, 1, for your notes, Solomon writes that a good name is better than precious ointment. Our name represents our reputation, our credibility, what we are known for and believed to be. In life, our name, our reputation can be a great help to us, can be worth more than riches. A good reputation can open doors for you that would otherwise be closed or can win you great favor among people. However, a bad name, a bad reputation can be a great detriment and hindrance. Have you ever been shopping at a store and a particular item on the shelf catches your eye? You walk over to it, you pick it up, and you admire it, and think to yourself that you just found a mighty fine purchase. And then you turn it over and see one of those little silver stickers on it, made in China. Isn't it funny how a little sticker can change your attitude? A moment ago, you were interested in this product. Now, what do you think about it now? Do you question its quality? Are you concerned about its safety? What if that little sticker had said, made in the USA? or German engineered. Janet tells me that in the product descriptions for clothing and fashion items, that if a product was made in a country that's known for its quality, it will typically say so. Well, made in Italy or made in France. However, if it's made elsewhere, the description will often just say imported. Whether we like it or not, our name means something. So how can we build a good reputation? How can we build a good name for ourselves? And why is this important? I'd like to take my time to focus on this today, to talk about how we build and protect our good name and the impact and importance of maintaining a good name for ourselves. How we build and protect our good name and the impact and importance of maintaining a good name for ourselves. And the first way that we can build a good name for ourselves is by doing good. By doing good. We'll get started in the book of Proverbs. Let's turn to Proverbs 20, verse 11. We're just there in Proverbs. Proverbs 20 and verse 11. It says, "Even a child is known by his deeds, whether what he does is pure and right." The Bible teaches us that our deeds are critical to building a good name for ourselves. Our reputation is shaped by our actions more so than our words or beliefs, even from a very young age. As the race for president in the United States starts to heat up again, we'll be hearing a lot of words, you know, a lot of bold promises and strong statements from a lot of politicians. And we'll hear a lot more before it's done. But the words of a politician don't mean much to us, do they? Because they're politicians. And simply carrying that name lends a certain distrust to everything they say. We don't trust politicians because so often their words do not line up with their actions. Their words do not carry the weight that their actions do. Let's turn to Matthew 23. Matthew 23, and we'll read verse 1. Matthew 23, 1. Then Jesus spoke to the multitudes and to his disciples, saying, "The scribes and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat. Therefore, whatever they tell you to do, observe. That observe and do, but do not do according to their works. For they say and do not do. For they bind heavy burdens hard to bear and lay them on men's shoulders, but they themselves will not move them with one of their fingers." Christ sharply criticized the Pharisees in multiple places because of their hypocrisy. These men said all the right things, but their actions did not follow suit. And so their reputation was not that of good men, but that of hypocrites. To call someone a Pharisee today is to call them a hypocrite. If we want to have a good name for ourselves, we must do good, not merely say the right things. A second way, moving on to a second way we can build a good name for ourselves is by staying humble. By staying humble. Career in the Continental Army, Benedict Arnold was passed over for promotion multiple times in favor of men with less merit. Arnold's actions and leadership during the early years of the war were critical to keeping the British forces in Canada from descending from the north to join the fight against Washington's army. Against superior forces and numbers, Arnold delayed and defeated the British time and again. And for his efforts, he was shot in the leg not once, but three times on three different occasions. But he never achieved the command that he had earned. And when he was passed over for promotion, he would let his ire be known. You see, Benedict Arnold was a proud man who offended many and let his displeasure be known when things didn't go his way. Multiple times, Arnold resigned or attempted to resign his commission after being passed over for promotion or after being slighted by a superior. Adult-sized temper tantrums were a recurring theme in Arnold's story. In fact, twice, George Washington himself had to soothe his ego and talk him into staying on. Though arguably a patriot, at least for a time, Arnold was most definitely seeking his own glory, not just a noble cause. He wanted the recognition, the gratitude, position, and power that he felt he deserved. And when he didn't receive it, his attitude soured, and he eventually betrayed the cause and the people he once fought so hard for. Let's pick up where we left off in Matthew 23. Matthew 23:5. But all their works they do to be seen by men. They make their phylacteries broad and enlarge the borders of their garments. They love the best places at feasts, the best seats in the synagogues, greetings in the marketplaces, and to be called by men, Rabbi, Rabbi. But you do not be called Rabbi. For one is your teacher, the Christ, and you are all brethren. Do not call anyone on earth your father, for one is your father, he who is in heaven. And do not be called teachers, for one is your teacher, Christ. But he who is greatest among you shall be your servant. And whoever exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. To build a good name, we must always have the right intentions. If we do the right things for the wrong reasons, if we seek only our own selfish ambitions in doing good, then this will become clear and our reputation will suffer. People have a knack for seeing through hypocrisy. Like a politician glad-handing the cops and kissing babies, our reputation will be suspect if our good deeds appear to be driven by selfish ambition. If we just do the right things for the wrong reasons. Instead, we should do good out of humility, to glorify God, not ourselves. Let's turn to Luke chapter 18. Luke chapter 18 and verse 9. Luke 18, 9. Also, he spoke this parable. Some trusted in themselves that they were righteous and despised others. Two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee stood and prayed thus with himself, God, I thank you that I am not like other men, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even as this tax collector. I fast twice a week. I give tithes of all that I possess. And the tax collector, standing afar off, would not so much as raise his eyes to heaven, but beat his breast, saying, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. I tell you, this man went down to his house justified rather than the other. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. By remaining humble and doing good for the right reasons, we will build a good name for ourselves. A third way that we can build a good name for ourselves is by avoiding the appearance of evil. By avoiding the appearance of evil. If someone were to do an internet search on your name right now, what would appear? When a potential employer or a camp organizer Googles your name, what do they see? What photos might show up? What posts on your social media accounts would they read? What impression would they be left with? Today, more than ever, it's so easy to have one's faults, missteps, and youthful indiscretions exposed for all the world to see, forever engraved upon the ether that is the internet. And not just our mistakes, but even the innocently meant photos of us that cast us in a poor light, or quotes taken out of context. And all these things can damage our good name. things people can point at to discredit us. Let's turn to the book of Proverbs again. Proverbs 22 and verse 3. Proverbs chapter 22 and verse 3. It says, a prudent man foresees evil and hides himself, but the simple pass on and are punished. When I read this passage, I think of people like Joseph, you know, people who avoided even the presence of Potiphar's wife for fear of what could happen, or what might seem to be happening, or fear of what others might perceive to be happening. Or I think of Daniel, whom the satraps sought diligently to accuse of some wrongdoing, but they could find nothing against him. Now, like these and others before us, we too should seek to be and to appear blameless in all things. We should avoid situations and places and individuals that could mar our good name by association. Let's turn to another chapter in Titus. Titus chapter 2 and verse 7. Titus 2 and verse 7. In all things, showing yourself to be a pattern of good works. In doctrine, showing integrity, reverence, incorruptibility, sound speech that cannot be condemned, that one who is an opponent may be ashamed, having nothing evil to say of you. If we are careful, not merely to say good things, but to do them with good and humble intent, and if we diligently seek to avoid even the appearance of evil, we can make a good name for ourselves. But a good name once built must be protected against those who would damage it. A good name once built must be protected against those who would damage it. So a fourth way that we can build a good name is by protecting it from the actions of others. By protecting it from the actions of others. If I were to ask you, who are the big four? Would that mean anything to you? If you work in the accounting sector, or even if you don't, you'll likely know what I'm referring to when I say the big four. The big four are the largest international business consulting firms in the world. It's composed of the businesses of PricewaterhouseCoopers, Deloitte & Touche, Ernst & Young, and KPMG. Until 2001, this group was called the Big Five because it included a fifth company called Arthur Anderson. It's been a while, but does that name ring any bells? In October 2001, Arthur Anderson was exposed as a key player in a financial scandal that rocked the corporate world and affected thousands. The scandal led to the bankruptcy of a Fortune 500 company with over $63.4 billion in assets, the second largest corporate bankruptcy in history. Today, we call this the Enron scandal. Arthur Anderson was Enron's auditor and was convicted for its complicity with Enron in accounting fraud, though they did their best to hide this by destroying thousands of relevant documents and emails and communique. As a result of this scandal, this member of the Big Five surrendered its license as a certified public accountant, and the company crumbled, its reputation shattered. Today, Arthur Anderson is a tiny shell of its former self. Now let me ask you another question. Have you ever heard of a company called Accenture? Until 2001, mere months before the Enron scandal broke out and rocked the financial world, Accenture went by the name of Anderson Consulting because they were the business consulting subsidiary of Arthur Anderson. Talk about dodging a bullet, eh? No sooner had Anderson Consulting broken away and renamed themselves Accenture before their former parent company crumbled into catastrophic ruin in the wake of one of the greatest corporate scandals in history. What would have happened to Accenture if they hadn't broken free and changed their name when they did? Would they have become a casualty of the Enron scandal through guilt by association? How many clients would they have lost? How many people would have been laid off? But instead of this, Accenture is thriving. For 15 years after the Enron scandal, Accenture's stock increased at 10 times the rate of the S&P 500. And their clientele included 94 of the Fortune Global 100 companies and 80% of the Fortune Global 500. Talk about successful. Our reputation is not something that is only passed based in the things that we say and do. Our good name can and is affected by the words and deeds of others, for better or for worse. Let's turn to the book of First Samuel. Read at this. 1 Samuel 25, and we'll start reading in verse 2. First Samuel 25, 2. Now there was a man in Maon whose business was in Carmel, and the man was very rich. He had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats, and he was shearing his sheep in Carmel. The name of the man was Nabal, and the name of his wife Abigail. And she was a woman of good understanding and beautiful appearance. But the man was harsh and evil in his doings. He was of the house of Caleb. When David heard in the wilderness that Nabal was shearing his sheep, David sent 10 young men and said, David said to the young men, go up to Carmel, go to Nabal and greet him in my name. And thus you shall say to him who lives in prosperity, peace be to you, peace to your house and peace to all that you have. Now I have heard that you have shearers. Your shepherds were with us, and we did not hurt them, nor was there anything missing from them all the while they were in Carmel. Ask your young men, and they will tell you. Therefore, let my young men find favor in your eyes, for we come on a feast day. Please give whatever comes to your hand to your servants and to your son David. So when David's young men came, they spoke to Nabal according to all these words in the name of David, and waited. Then Nabal answered David's servants and said, who is David, and who is the son of Jesse? There are many servants nowadays who break away each from his master. Shall I then take my bread and my water and my meat that I have killed for my shearers and give it to men when I do not know where they are from? So David's young men turned on their heels and went back, and they came and told him all these words. Then David said to his men, every man gird on his sword. So every man girded on his sword, and David also girded on his sword, and about 400 men went with David, and 200 stayed with the supplies. Now one of the young men told Abigail, Nabal's wife, saying, look, David sent messengers from the wilderness to greet our master, and he reviled them. But the men were very good to us, and we were not hurt, nor did we miss anything as long as we accompanied them when we were in the fields. They were a wall to us both by night and day, all the time we were with them keeping the sheep. Now, therefore, no one can do, for harm is determined against our master and against all his household, for he is such a scoundrel that no one cannot speak to him. Then Abigail made haste and took 200 loaves of bread, 2 skins of wine, 5 sheep already dressed, 5 seahs of roasted grain, 100 clusters of raisins, and 200 cakes of figs, and loaded them on donkeys. And she said to her servants, go on before me, see, I am coming after you. But she did not tell her husband, Nabal. So it was as she rode on the donkey that she went down under cover of the hill, and there were David and his men coming down toward her, and she met them. Now David had said, surely in vain I have protected all that this fellow has in the wilderness, so that nothing was missed of all that belongs to him, and he has repaid me evil for good. May God do so and more also to the enemies of David, if I leave one male of all who belong to him by morning light. Now when Abigail saw David, she dismounted quickly from the donkey, fell on her face before David, and bowed down to the ground. And so she fell at his feet and said, oh, on me, my Lord, on me let this iniquity be. And please let your maidservant speak in your ears and hear the words of your maidservant. Please let not my Lord regard this scoundrel Nabal. For as his name is, so is he. Nabal is his name, and folly is with him. But I, your maidservant, did not see the young man of my Lord whom you sent. Now, therefore, my Lord, as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, since the Lord has held you back from coming to bloodshed, and from avenging yourself with your own hand. Now then, let your enemies and those who seek harm for my lord be as Nabal. And now this present which your maidservant has brought to my lord, let it be given to the young men who follow my lord. Please forgive the trespass of your maidservant, for the Lord will certainly make for my lord an enduring house, because my lord fights the battles of the Lord, and evil is not found in you throughout your days. Skipping to verse 32. Then David said to Abigail, blessed is the Lord God of Israel, who sent you this day to meet me. And blessed is your advice, and blessed are you, because you have kept me this day from coming to bloodshed and from avenging myself with my own hand. For indeed, as the Lord God of Israel lives, who has kept me back from hurting you, unless you had hurried and come to me, surely by morning light, no males would have been left to Nabal. By Abigail's wise intervention, she not only saved many lives, but protected her good name and the name of her household, and also David's. What would have become of David's name if he had done what he intended to do? But Abigail prevented him and protected his good name as well. Our actions affect the good name of those close to us, for good or for evil. So when we behave well or poorly, it can affect how people view our family, for example. You know, as brethren, we have a shared reputation as a congregation, as a church. So when we're hospitable or rude to guests who visit from other areas, it affects our good name as a congregation. We all share the name of American. So when we travel abroad, our actions affect the reputation of our nation, the name of our nation. We are ambassadors for our family, for our friends, our nation, and for our church, and our actions affect their reputation. But more than these, we have another greater ambassadorship. Let's turn to 2 Corinthians 5 and start reading in verse 20. That's 2 Corinthians 5 and verse 20. Now then, we are ambassadors for Christ. As though God were pleading through us, we implore you on Christ's behalf, be reconciled to God. Brethren, when you and I are baptized in the name of the Father and the Son and of the Holy Spirit, we become ambassadors for this way of life. And our words and our actions will not only affect our reputation, they will affect God's. Let's turn to Romans 2 and verse 17. Let's back up this point by turning to Romans 2 and verse 17. Indeed, you are called a Jew and rest on the law and make your boast in God and know his will and prove the things that are excellent, being instructed out of the law, and are confident that you yourself are a guide to the blind, a light to those who are in darkness, an instructor of the foolish, a teacher of babes, having the form of knowledge and truth in the law. You therefore who teach another, do you not teach yourself? You who preach that a man should not steal, do you steal? You who say do not commit adultery, do you commit adultery? You who abhor idols, do you rob temples? You who make your boast in the law, do you dishonor God through breaking the law? For the name of God is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you, as it is written. When we take on the name of Christian and then behave in unchristian manner, people do not only see us in a less positive light. They see Christianity in a less positive light. They see God in a less positive light. How many times have you heard people say things like, well, if they're an indication of what it means to be religious or what it means to be a Christian, then I want nothing to do with religion or Christianity. When it comes down to it, the importance of building our good name is not simply about us. It's not about the benefits that we receive from a good reputation or the respect or the favor. It's about the glory our Father receives in heaven. by doing things with good intent, by being humble and avoiding even the appearance of evil, our good name improves. But this also improves the reputation of God, the reputation of our family and of our congregation, and the eyes of those who meet us, hear about us. How delighted have you been when you hear things like, oh, you're from the Twin Cities congregation. Oh, I met so-and-so at the feast. You must have a great congregation. They're such great people. You know, or things like, oh, you're so-and-so's mom and dad. I met your children. You must have such a great family. I have just two more scriptures before we wrap up. Let's turn to Revelation. Revelation chapter 3. Let's start reading in verse 12. Revelation 3 and verse 12. He who overcomes, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God, and he shall go out no more. In the name of the city of my God, the New Jerusalem, which comes down out of heaven from my God, and I will write on him my new name. Jumping back a little earlier in this chapter, we also read in Revelation 3 and verse 5, he who overcomes shall be clothed in white garments, and I will not blot out his name from the book of life, but I will confess his name before my Father and before his angels. What name are you building, brethren? How does it affect the ones you love? Can God trust you to represent him as an ambassador? According to legend, after Benedict Arnold had defected to the British, he asked an American captive officer, what will the Americans do to me if they catch me? And the captive's reply was this: they will cut off the leg that was wounded when you were fighting so gloriously for the cause of liberty, and bury it with the honors of war, and hang the rest of your body on a gibbet. Interestingly, there is another monument on the battlefield of Saratoga. It's called the Boot Monument. It looks like a simple granite gravestone with a cavalryman's boot engraved upon it. The inscription on the Boot Monument reads, "In memory of the most brilliant soldier of the Continental Army, who was desperately wounded on this spot, winning for his countrymen the decisive battle of the American Revolution, and for himself the rank of Major General." This is said to be the only memorial in the United States that does not bear the name of its honoree. Instead, the credit is given to the boot of a man whose name is forever absent from the monument to his greatest achievement. What name are you building? How will you be remembered? Family, someday, God will inscribe his great name on his saints and eternally affix their names to the book of life. Will your name be there?